Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and joining me is a woman who has been called a little batty. It's Lydia.
Eek, 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 eek. Bats don't really go eek, eek, eek. I mean, I guess they do.
Kind of. They scream.
Yeah.
Yell a little bit.
I mean, you know, people scream when they see them, I guess. I mean, the classic go-to is rabies, rabies, but I'm showing my age.
Well, before we go any further, thanks everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphaned Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. It really does help get the show in front of more people that way and hopefully into more ears. You can follow the link in our in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we've covered here on the show. If you would like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. Let's listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we'll see if we can't unmask the Bat.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call The Illegal Entry. Police had a drunken sailor in custody on a vagrancy charge when the man produced a roll of money that added up to several thousand dollars. I questioned the man, who said he was celebrating Christmas, had gotten leave from his ship on the way to Chicago through the St. Lawrence Seaway nearby. Although the man had seaman's papers, I was convinced he was trying to enter the country illegally. In a moment, I'll tell you why.
Prepare for a spine-tingling, nerve-shattering podcast featuring all your favorite monsters. You won't believe your ears when you listen to Monster Kid Radio. Hear your host, Derek M. Cook, and his ever-rotating stable of guests discuss your favorite classic and sometimes not-so-classic monster movies. Subscribe to Monster Kid Radio through iTunes or Stitcher, or visit monsterkidradio.net before the next weekly episode of Monster Kid Radio. Go through the archives for interviews with Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price, and Joel Hodgson. Listen to the discussions about movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Island of Terror, and King Kong. And don't forget convention coverage from Monster Bash and the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, Classic Monsters, Modern Talk, and the head of Rondo Hatton. Only on Monster Radio.
Of the illegal entry. The sailor said he was celebrating Christmas and that his ship was in the St. Lawrence Seaway. The seaway is closed during most of the winter. The sailor was a little lost at sea. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
The Bat was released in 1959 on a double bill with the Hammer Studios version of The Mummy. It was produced by Liberty Pictures and distributed by Allied Artists. Crane Wilbur wrote the screenplay as well as directed. This movie is a third film adaptation of the 1908 Mary Roberts Rinehart novel, The Circular Staircase. The first movie was a 1926 silent film of the same name, and it was followed by a 1930 film titled The Bat Whispers. I went ahead and said third. I did see somewhere that there may have been one that predated the 1926, but I couldn't get a real confirmation on it. It would have been a really early silent film. So yeah. I'll just stick with the two films prior to this that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
The film stars Agnes Moorehead as Cornelia Van Gorder. Vincent Price as Dr. Malcolm Wells. Lenita Lane, who was married to Crane Wilbur, plays Cornelia's longtime maid. Gavin Gordon is Police Lieutenant Andy Anderson, a actor and a character that likes alliteration. And Darla Hood appears as Judy Hollander. Darla Hood is best known for appearing as Darla in the R-Gang comedy shorts from 1935 to 1941. The Bat will be her last film appearance. She'll leave Hollywood for the most part and find some amount of success as a singer. In the film, famed mystery author Cornelia Van Gorder rents a large mansion called The Oaks on the outskirts of a small town for the summer. The owner of the home, John Fleming, is the local bank's president, who happens to be on a hunting trip with his physician, Malcolm Wells. Fleming confides in Wells that he has stolen $1 million in negotiable securities from his own bank, and he's pinned the theft on the bank cashier. He's willing to split the money with Wells if he helps him fake his death. Fleming admits to having hidden the money, and Wells correctly deduces that he did so somewhere in the Oaks. A forest fire happens to encroach on the cabin that the two are staying at, which gives Wells the opportunity to turn the tables on Fleming and murder him, with his sights on finding and keeping all the money himself. Meanwhile, the town is abuzz with rumors that a serial killer may have returned to the area, a man known as the Bat, who murdered several people in and around the Oaks. Most of Cornelius' servants have left out of fear after reportedly seeing a strange man without a face and hearing odd noises throughout the night. Cornelius is determined to ferret out the identity of the Bat and find the money if it is in the house, all the while making a new best-selling novel out of the adventure.
Like you do.
I'm sure we've talked a bit about Vincent Price, as he has appeared on the show before. In film, we talked about Shock in May of 2013 and The Last Man on Earth in the August of that same year. And we perhaps spoke a little about him when we listened to him narrate A Christmas Carol from 1949 during one of our commentary episodes in December of 2017. So on to Agnes Moorehead. Born in 1900, though she would often put her birth year as 1906 to appear younger, got the bug to act after performing in her Presbyterian clergyman's father's church. As a child, she and her sister would sit around the dinner table with the family mimicking their father's parishioners to their parents' amusement. As a young woman, she joined the chorus in St. Louis Municipal Opera Company, and later, while studying biology in college at Muskingum College in Concord, Ohio, performed in many school stage productions. When her family moved to Wisconsin, she taught public school for a number of years while earning a master's degree in English and public speaking, and pursued postgraduate studies at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, where she would graduate with honors in 1929. Her early acting career was the typical starving artist type of career, often finding herself going without food for days. She found some work in radio and soon found herself in demand for her distinctive voice and her ability to do characterizations. She would often do several programs in a single day. By 1937, she had joined Orson Welles' Mercury Players as one of their principal players, including a regular role as Margot Lane in the company's serial production of The Shadow opposite Orson Welles. Welles moved the company from New York to Hollywood when he began working for RKO Pictures. Many of his staff joined him, including Moorehead, and she made her film debut as in 1941's Citizen Kane. She appeared in Welles' follow-up film, The Magnificent Ambersons, in 1942, which garnered her a New York Film Critic Award and an Academy Award nomination. She would receive another nomination in 1944 for the film Mrs. Parkington. Soon after that, she began working for MGM as a contract player, and she would portray everything from comical secretaries to neurotic spinsters and puritanical matrons. By the 1950s and through the 60s, she continued to work in film and on stage, and she appeared with John Wayne and Susan Hayward in the Howard Hughes 1956 film The Conqueror, a film that that would have a huge impact on her later life. She would appear in many more films alongside Vincent Price in today's subject, The Bat, and also would star along with Betty Davis, Olivia de Havilland, Mary Astor, and Joseph Cotten in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, 1964, which she was again nominated for another Academy Award. On television, Moorehead had several guest roles on series like The Twilight Zone, Rawhide, and The Rifleman, and The Wild Wild West, the latter of which would win her a Primetime Emmy Award. But the role she is probably best known for is the mortal-loathing witch mother-in-law in Dora in the television comedy series Bewitched, starring with Elizabeth Montgomery and Dick York and later Dick Sargent. She would receive 6 Emmy nominations for the part. Though she was always quick to remind interviewers that she had a long and distinguished career prior to her television work. She would stay with the show for its entire run until 1972, despite feeling it was not a terribly challenging part, but enjoyed her time working with Montgomery and liked that her colorful character appealed to children. The early 70s became increasingly difficult for Moorhead due to declining health, and one of her last film roles would be providing the voice of the Goose in Hanna-Barbera's Charlotte's Web. She was working in a Broadway production adaptation of Gigi in 1973 when she fell ill from uterine cancer. She and many of her co-stars and crew of The Conqueror suffered cancer-related illnesses and deaths due to their close proximity to detonation of atmospheric atomic bomb tests while filming.
Oh.
Of the 220 cast and crew, People magazine ascertained that 91 of them developed some form of cancer and 46 of those died of the disease.
Wow.
Moorhead passed away in 1974 and was entombed in a crypt near her father at Dayton Memorial Park Cemetery in Dayton, Ohio, which I have actually visited in this past year. I visited the grave of Agnes Moorhead. Yeah, the story of the atomic bomb test and The Conqueror is crazy. They were filming out in the desert, and on the horizon, there's flashes of literally atomic bombs going off, and then a lot of the dust and fallout would fall onto the film set.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy, and it's scary how many people were affected by it.
We will not talk about that. We will not talk about how things should have gone, but that's incredible. Unfortunately, it should be more shocking than it is. It is shocking, but compared to now, just the knowledge that we had about that, about all of that, is just so limited. So, and that is tragic.
I believe I tried to watch this film once prior to us covering it here on the show. I think it just failed to hold my attention. I remember sitting down and watching. I remember watching Agnes and seeing Agnes Moorhead on the screen. I know Vincent Price, but I didn't remember the actual events or the story prior to watching it for this. I had to, when I sat down to watch it for the show, certainly the first time, I had to truly actually make myself focus to watch.
Yeah. Well, both Price and Moorhead are so well known. Like, they're so iconic. And it's fun scrolling through her list of credits. Like, every movie in here, I'm like, oh, I want to watch that. Oh, I want to watch that. And I can't even think of any, I can't think of any movies looking through the list. I mean, I know I've seen Pollyanna, right? But I couldn't tell you who Agnes Moorhead was in it. I know that there are movies, The Opposite Sex. She's the Countess in The Opposite Sex. If you guys get a chance to see The Opposite Sex, highly recommended. It's June Allison, who's of course lovely. Also, I know I mention this all the time, a young Leslie Nielsen, still with dark hair, playing a serious love interest. It's so enjoyable to watch. And so when I saw her in this, of course, immediately she was familiar to me. And so it's hard to see her in anything that if you've seen her before, it's hard to see her in anything and not immediately know who she is and immediately feel like she's familiar. I think she either got extremely lucky or was very good at picking parts, because there's so many movies in here. I think, you know, of course, Citizen Kane being critically acclaimed and all of that. I have yet to meet anybody who says it's their favorite movie. It's a critically acclaimed, fascinating film, but does it make you feel really good at the end of the day? Nah, you know. But she was in an early adaptation of Jane Eyre, and like, you could just go through the list and go, oh, I want to see that. I want to see that. That looks so good. I think part of it is, The irony maybe is that she's not going to be main parts or the main character in any of these movies. But in every movie, her character is fabulous and fascinating. And so it's fun to see a movie where she is the main character.
Oh, very true. I know her more for television than I do for film. Doing the research for this, I was a little surprised that, you know, she goes from starving artist on stage to finding success in radio, And then Orson Welles, like, oh, hey, you want to be in this film I'm doing called Citizen Kane? Yeah, sure. And it turns out to be one of, you know, what many critics consider one of the greatest films ever made. I'm like, wow, that's a hell of a lucky break. And then, you know, her next, I believe she actually got an Academy Award nomination for that film. I don't think I mentioned that, but I believe she did. And then she follows up with another Orson Welles film and gets another nomination. She would get a total of four nominations in her career.
Wow.
Never taking home a statuette, but she would get four nominations, which is still, I think, impressive for somebody who was struggling and really just got super lucky. Right place, right time.
Yeah.
And just the first two films, oh, welcome to the Academy Awards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we downplay the Emmys, but I don't think that's anything to sneeze at either. Yeah, the stereotype for poor TV acting doesn't mean that all TV acting is poor. There's some exceptional roles out there and some exceptional performances. So that itself is a really huge deal.
I didn't look to see if she got, like I said, she was nominated for like, what, six Emmys just for Bewitched alone?
Yeah, that's amazing.
I didn't actually see how many, oh, here it is. I was just looking to see how many she actually won. I don't know that she actually ever won any of the Emmys other than the Wild Wild West episode. She actually won a primetime Emmy for that. Bewitched, she was just nominated but never won. She did win a Golden Globe for Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte. She won a Golden Globe for Mrs. Parkington. And the New York Film Critics Circle gave her a Best Actress for The Magnificent Ambersons.
Have you watched, I'm going to sidetrack us just a little bit here, but have you watched The Wild Wild West?
Yeah. I love that show.
My husband's been going through it, and I'll kind of be doing something else. I'll be on my computer or writing or whatever. And then inevitably, if I glance up and look at the screen, I am unable to look away again. It's yes. James Bond in the West, in the
yes,
old West.
Oh, very
it's,
much.
And it's silly and it's a lot of fun. And there's a femme fatale every single episode. And it's just fun. I think it's worth watching. And I love that she not only was in it, but actually won an award for being in it. It's so different.
Have you ever seen the Twilight Zone episode in which she appears?
No, I have. Well, I don't know. I should say I've only seen a few Twilight Zone episodes.
Okay. This particular one, she is a mute woman living in very rural America somewhere. You know, she's in a shack and a small spaceship lands on her roof, and she's kind of terrorized by these little like 6-7-8 inch astronauts.
Wow.
And so there's no really any dialogue almost through the entire episode. Oh, it's an hour long story, I think.
Yeah.
And she's being terrorized, and I'm not gonna give away the it's a Twilight
Thanks.
Zone.
So yeah, don't give away the ending.
I'm not gonna give it away. But it's an astonishing episode, and you are riveted to the screen the whole time. And she is amazing, and she doesn't speak a word.
I have noticed that with a few different shows lately. They'll do one episode. A great example is Only Murders in the Building. They did an episode where there's a young man that's deaf, and so the whole episode has no dialogue in it at all. There are subtitles and you can see people moving their mouths, but you don't hear anything. It's completely without verbal dialogue or audible dialogue. There's another show, there's a British show, I can't think what it's called right now. They did the same thing where it's not even that there's a deaf person, it's that nobody speaks through the whole episode. And those episodes are just riveting. We don't really appreciate how much we rely on all of our senses to absorb what's going on until one is taken away and we're forced to pay attention. It's really fascinating. Another classic scene is Kill Bill, the coffin scene. I won't get into it if you haven't seen it. It's one of those things, but when you have one of your senses taken away, when they do that effectively on the screen, it's just riveting. It's so good.
Moments like that, whether it's an entire episode of a series or a film or whatever, you have to have a cast member that can carry the film.
And yes.
When I'm watching something like The Twilight Zone with this Agnes Moorehead as this character. Yeah, I don't think there's many other actors that could have done it. And it's amazing for a woman that is probably best known for her voice, for the way she speaks, like in Bewitched or even in this film, in The Bat. I think it's a lot of fun that, there's more to her than just her voice. She's damn good. That's really what it boils down to.
Yes, yeah. Side note, it's Inside Number 9 is the series I was thinking of that also does that, if you guys are curious for something a little bit different. Let's go back to The Bat. I knew I was going to sidetrack us really badly with that.
Easy to do.
It is. I think it's interesting that you struggled to keep your attention on this movie. It feels like it all, you know what it almost feels like to me is, remember that when they used to do the Playhouse movies, the made for TV Playhouse movies, and it's not necessarily that the production values are abysmal. They're definitely of their time. But it's almost more, there's almost a feeling of it being like an episode of a bigger movie. And there are moments where people will say a line of dialogue and it almost feels like it's hearkening back to a previous episode. And certainly Agnes Moorehead's character in this, who I'm scrambling to remember her name, Van Gorder.
Cornelia. Cornelia. How can you forget Cornelia?
Thank you. She is a well-known mystery writer in this movie, and so there are people referencing her work throughout it, and she occasionally will say a line that you can kind of get that she's referencing her work, but the effect is that you have the feeling that you should already know these characters. And of course, with it being Vincent Price, again, you have this feeling that you should already know this character. So I don't think it requires you to pay a lot of attention, just partially because these are not new types of characters. And very, very early in the movie, they reveal the plot of a murder that, you know, whether it takes place or not, you know, I think ultimately the man goes missing and then they're, you know, speculating, oh, did he run away? But we know that he was with Dr. Wells. And so maybe he's been killed, you know, probably he's been killed. And so it almost feels like there's not a mystery to solve. The mystery of the identity of the Bat, who is the serial killer, is not really much of a mystery.
Well, it's not, the mystery isn't that it's not Vincent Price's character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the movie tries very hard to like point the finger at Vincent Price. But when the character of the Bat is on screen, the way he moves, his appearance, it's like, that's not Vincent Price.
Right. And you mentioned to me last week, I think, you said, hey, there's an earlier version of this. If you get a chance to watch it, watch it. And I did.
Oh,
and
good.
It is not shot for shot identical. They definitely were able to do some things in the 1959 version that they couldn't have done in the 1929 version. But it is
26.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry. But it is almost identical. The mm-hmm. story is pretty much the same. The character roles are all there. I think the only things they didn't do was there's a scene where somebody's driving in a car. And then Cornelia's character in the original is just a nice old lady who's off for vacation renting this house instead of being a famous writer. So, you know, it's limited again by the time that it was, the time period that it was made.
I like the 26, the Bat isn't like a murdering serial killer. He's just a thief.
And he can fly. Am I the only one that laughed when he landed on the roof? And this is the 1926 version, guys. Don't go watch the 1959 one that we're talking about and say, I don't remember the Bat flying. He didn't. But in the 1926 one, he flies in and he lands on either a police station roof or a hotel roof. I can't remember what it was. But I thought, man, that the bat effect over this building is way too big. And then he lands on the roof and I started laughing because I was like, I love it, though, because it's 1926. Of course he can fly. It's 1926.
I missed that. Are you sure you just didn't see a bat flying and then him climbing up?
You know? No, I'm like 99% sure that a man-sized bat lands on the roof of a prop house
or building. I'll have to go back and rewatch it.
Yeah, it may be just one of those things where I got interrupted, but I'm so sure that he actually is able to fly in it. And it totally made me laugh. But I also thought, you know, this is the era when men could land, not only land on the moon, but actually shoot their rocket into the eye of the moon. And so it was fine, right? I'm totally okay with it. But I loved that. I found it very interesting, first of all, that this is, of course, a recycled movie. But that they chose to keep as much of it the same as they did. And I'm actually really charmed by that. I think I'm really happy that they didn't try and turn it around into a police drama or something like that. And I was really impressed with the 1926 having, I'm going to use the term. Are you guys ready? Hold on to your seats. Having a strong female character. I loved that she at one point says, oh, there's somebody on the roof. I can hear him. And the police officers take off up a ladder. And then she turns to the two women with her and says, now that those two bozos are gone, and this is in the 1926 version, let's go find out what's really happening. I love it. Mm-hmm. I was surprised and very, very pleased. But because of that, I'm more, I think, enchanted with this movie than I would have been if it had been a remake, but not stuck closely to the 1926 version.
Oh, interesting. I don't know what it is. I think it's because the plot of this film is a little, and the script, actually, it's just a little unsteady for me. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the first time I sat down to watch it, I had to sort of force myself to watch the screen and pay attention. I went to watch it a second time, and I'll admit it, my attention was constantly, I was finding myself looking at my phone or fiddling with something else and realizing, oh, crud, 15 minutes have already gone by in this film. I've already watched it once.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I don't think that it's a deeply captivating storyline. Mm-hmm. There's nothing especially new done in it. There's not really the mystery's not really that much of a mystery. It's more it's funny. It almost feels to me, it almost feels like a comedic Agatha Christie. Like they were like, oh, Agatha Christie had been writing at this point.
You know what it feels like to me? It's probably very similar. This has got all the drama of a murder she wrote.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Very similar, I think. That there's all. It's like a. It's almost low stakes murder mystery.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like Murder, She Wrote. It was an hour long, and you know, it's just primetime television. It's not going to be anything serious. It's not going to be particularly dark. There's going to be a couple little winks at the camera.
Yes.
And like that's really. I almost wonder if Murder, She Wrote was inspired by this
by something like this. I think that's the sort of thing I was trying to say when I said it feels almost like it's an episode in the middle of a series. And so like we've seen all these things happen before, we're familiar with the main character, we know that she's gonna solve it, we never really think her life is in danger, her maid who likes to scream constantly is never really gonna have her life in danger, we know, right? The sidekick, or you know, the beautiful woman in it, she's never really gonna be in danger. You know, it's just, that's just not how it's going to happen. I think I don't want to get too far down the road in it. I guess the question is, were there any parts? I found it interesting that, of course, the doctor has this obsession with bats. You know, they were pushing you very, very hard to in a specific direction. not really sure what that had to do with anything, but they were. There was also a bit of, it's not quite slapstick with the maid, but it's a little like slapstick. It's hard to take this movie very seriously.
You definitely can't take it seriously. The women are scared to death that there's a prowler. The bat could be in the house. Oh, well, we'll lock ourselves in my bedroom. We'll stay together. And then literally seconds later, oh, I forgot my night clothes. Yes. I'm going to go out and I'm like, wait.
I like that they go to the trouble of setting up a booby trap so that they'll be, you know, alerted if somebody's breaking in. And then the booby trap doesn't even work. No. I'm like, and I'm thinking how, wow, he would have had, oh, I did, I also don't know if you caught the moment where they, where the bat cuts the glass with a key, with an actual physical door key.
And no, I thought, it's a glass cutter.
Oh, it looked like a door key. Okay, thank you for that. Mystery solved.
I have seen, and I've actually in my life possessed a glass cutter. That's what that looks like.
That makes me feel better because it looked like a key. It does look kind of key-like.
Yeah,
I really thought it was just bad special effects, but okay, thank you. Crisis averted. It's not that bad.
No, there's just moments where the script, at times I think the script for the bat is rather clever. And other times it's, why in the world did you say that? I like Lieutenant Andy Anderson, and they work really hard with him to make it look like he's trying to pin the identity of the bat as being Vincent Price.
Mm-hmm. He's out there.
Nobody you need to worry about, Doctor.
Oh, it's Andy.
That's right. Oh, good evening, Mr. Van Gordon.
Good evening, Lieutenant.
Somebody sick here?
My maid was bitten by a bat.
Oh? A rabid bat? Well, I'll know for sure when I get to my lab. I caught the bat. It happened indoors?
In my bedroom, yes.
How'd it get in?
Well, there are many ways a bat could get in a house.
You ought to know.
I spotted this hole in the window the minute I got here.
Why?
That's where the two-legged bat got your door open.
Miss Van Gorder told me that she phoned headquarters at Zenith.
Yes, I phoned twice. The second time was after the prowler got in the house.
Weren't headquarters handy?
No, but they contacted me.
An officer came and searched the house from top to bottom, but they couldn't find the bat.
You better have this window fixed tomorrow.
Oh, yes, I certainly shall.
Yes, and I'd better be going. I'm due in surgery at 8 o'clock in the morning. Good night.
Good night, Doctor.
There'll be a man patrolling the grounds all night, Miss Van Gorder.
Oh, thank you.
And nobody inside, Andy?
Why should there be?
Well, how do you know but what the bat is hiding somewhere in the house?
I'm quite sure he isn't in the house, Doctor. Not now. Good night.
Not now. Just as, you know, Vincent Price has stepped out onto the front porch of the home. And it's just, there's little bits of dialogue like that. It's like, it's kind of clever because... I don't want to give away the ending.
Yeah, they're telling you what's going on without telling you what's... They are... I'm going to use the phrase. They're showing, not telling. Because he's saying, I don't think the bat's here now. And instead of saying, well, I think you're the bat. They're doing what they're supposed to do with film.
But later on in the film, there's another scene. They're all sitting around and having tea. And Cornelia's explaining that her chauffeur is now her butler.
I see you've engaged new servants.
Yes, of course.
Well, how did you persuade them to live in this house?
Well, Jane Patterson, my new housekeeper, knows this house better than you do, Doctor. Huh? She worked for John Fleming, and Warner was my chauffeur.
Chauffeur turned butler?
That's incredible. He can play any part at a moment's notice. Did you get a plumber, Warner?
No, we can't get a plumber for 3 days, madam.
What about that leaking pipe? The basement will be flooded in 3 days.
Well, the pipe is no longer leaking.
You mean it's dried up of its own accord?
No, not quite. I packed the elbow where the water was coming out.
Packed the elbow? Where did you learn how to do that?
Well, into each life, a little rain must fall, and a careful man learns to keep himself dry. Now, is there anything else that you require, Miss Van Gorder?
No, not at the moment, Warner.
Thank you, madam.
Now, there's a character.
How long did you say that he worked for you as chauffeur?
About 3 months.
Well, I hope he doesn't have a police record.
Why would you say that?
Where did that come from?
I mean, that's what I think immediately when I think chauffeur to butler, yeah.
It's so odd, and that's not the only line. I think there's a couple times in this film where people just... say things that you're like, wow, that's kind of odd.
Doesn't feel conversational.
That's strangely specific.
Yeah. It might be interesting to go back and see how much of those odd things are pulled from the original movie. If any, it's possible that they aren't. Mm-hmm. But it does. This is neither high comedy nor high drama nor high mystery. It's kind of an interlude. Yeah. Interlude with a mystery. If it were a composition, that's what I'd call it. But it's not. Yeah.
I read that Vincent Price agreed to be in this film because he saw the stage play as a younger man, and he said the stage play scared him to death. So he was hoping that this film would reinvigorate the story and that maybe they would redo the stage play for modern audiences and everything. Oh. And in the end, he was a little disappointed in the film because he, as he put it, the script wasn't very good.
That is interesting. So he would have been about 15 when the first movie came out, when the mm-hmm. 1926 version came out. And so that's interesting. I didn't even look into whether there had been a play associated with it or not. And I think if the basing it on, again, the 1926 and not the 1959, I could see how, as a younger person, seeing that would have been very, could have been very frightening, very, very tense. And honestly, I think I was probably more entranced with the 1926 version than I was with the 1959 version.
Yeah, I kind of sat there. I almost went, is it too late to switch the films that we want to review?
and it is funny. It's tempting as it may be to say, oh, well, we'll just cover the 1929 version another time. It really is so, it's the same as this movie, just mm-hmm. with slight different, slightly different characterizations and, of course, different actors. But
some cracking special effects for 1926, though, I thought.
Yes, I think so, too.
Some of the camera work and the special effects in the 26 film are really impressive.
I actually think that the story is really excellent for 1926.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the whole thing is, it is definitely 1926, right? They're not doing anything groundbreaking by our standards with the camera, with the filming, with the shots or anything like that. Yes, the special effects for the time are good. The costuming for the time is of the time. But it is, I think probably, as action goes, it is much more captivating and keeps your attention much better than the 1959 version. Partly because you have to read the titles. You have to read the title cards. But also, or the dialogue cards, rather. But also because this story works better in that time and setting than it does in 1959. Partly, I think you're right, partly it's the dialogue. The dialogue in the 1926 version had to be pared down to fit the cue cards or to fit the cards. And so you didn't have the space for throwaway dialogue. But in the 1959 version, not only do you have the space for throwaway dialogue, you have the space for quips and for witty lines at the end of the movie spoken directly into the camera and, all that kind of thing. So I think it's interesting. This story for 1926 is good. It's advanced. It's interesting. It's captivating. For 1959, by now we've seen it. It is old, and it's over. Gosh, it's over 35 years old at that point. And there's a hundred different ways that this has been done better with sound and in color at this point. It makes sense that it came out as a double feature with something else. It really does.
It's particularly interesting, and maybe it only makes it feel a little worse because you've got such top-tier talent in the film. You've got Vincent Price. You've got Agnes Moorehead, Academy Award nominated three times by this time, Agnes mm-hmm. Moorehead in this film.
And she's excellent. She's captivating.
She's brilliant.
Yeah.
But what she has to work with is just... eh.
Yeah, she doesn't feel like she feels a little bit like, definitely carries a gun around with her, so feels a little bit tough. But something about a little old white-haired lady in 1926 heading up this group of three women going trying to figure out this mystery is more, it's a higher risk than Agnes Moorehead, who you feel is completely capable. Mm-hmm. At no point do you feel like she might be in danger.
He looks quite normal, doesn't seem to be sick at all.
Oh, ain't that nice. I've been worried about him.
Well, you should be. From his appearance, I'd say that he doesn't have any infection. In which case, you've had a narrow escape. Now, you take one of those tablets I left for you, and I'll guarantee you a good night. And I'll drop in on you tomorrow.
Oh, thanks for everything, Doctor.
Now, don't worry, I can find my way out.
Oh, I know you can, but do let me help you.
Oh, don't forget that once I'm gone, you'll have to climb those stairs alone.
Oh, I'm all right. I'm armed now.
Can you shoot one of those things without shutting your eyes?
Oh, Doctor, there are guns in every book I've ever written. I don't write about things I'm unfamiliar with. Lock the door, Lizzie.
Good night.
Yes, ma'am. Good night, Doctor.
So there's no risk to her. There's no risk to her maid. But in the 1926 version, there is to the character, the equivalent character. I don't recall if it's the same name or not. But it feels like there is actual true risk in the original one and not in this one. I mean, you know, aside from the guys that get killed, but they get killed off camera. And so there's no tension or buildup or drama. I think that's what's missing in this, is there is no tension in it.
Right. No, I agree.
And you kept waiting for it. Like when Vincent Price is talking, when the doctor is talking to the bank manager and they're suggesting killing somebody, you're like, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to get interesting. And then it just disappears.
It just stops.
It just ends. Yeah. And so there's none of the tension that you need to see to make this movie really successful. Because even when the bat is breaking into places, if you believe that it's Dr. Wells and he's looking for the money, you just know he just wants to scare the... And even in the movie, the way that it's played off is the bat's just trying to scare these women away so that he can look for the money.
Oh, it's very Scooby-Doo.
Yes, thank you. That's what I've been trying to get a handle on this whole time. I almost said that's what I've been trying to say, but it didn't enter my mind until you said that. But it's exactly that.
You would have gotten away with it, too, if it hadn't been for that...
Pesky Cornelia Van Gorder character. Yeah.
And
that's
maid.
Exactly what it is. Her and her maid, darn it. So yeah, this feels like a Scooby-Doo episode. The original feels like a 1926 silent film mystery. They're very different. And there is true risk and there are true stakes in the 26 version that there aren't in the 59 version.
Right. And again, I'll just highlight that I think it's just very disappointing with this cast. Yeah, Price, Moorehead. Gavin Gordon has got one of the greatest voices I think I've ever heard. And the way he speaks and his voice is brilliant. And again, he's actually maybe a highlight of the film for me. I think he does some of the best stuff. Lenita Lane as her maid, Lizzie, I think is a lot of fun. I think there's a really great comedic actress. I'm kind of curious to go and find her in other films.
Mm-hmm.
It just, with this one, it feels a little out of place at times.
Well, and it's definitely a direct carryover from the original script. There is the constantly screaming maid. She exists in the 26 version, so I know where she came from. Whether she plays well in 1959, I feel like the latest instances of that type of character playing off well are in the late 40s, and this is about a decade too late for that.
Mm-hmm. But so much effort by all the cast to try to make this as good as they can, I think. It unfortunately doesn't come through. But there are those little moments where I notice, like, what was his name? The bank cashier.
Is it Dale's husband?
Dale, yes. Victor Bailey.
Mm-hmm. We should remember that George Bailey worked in a bank too. Well,
that's right. We're introduced to him early on, and he's the one that discovers that these negotiable securities are missing. And when he comes and talks to Lieutenant Anderson and someone else, I noticed he looks stressed. He looks like he's sweating, you know, like he's really worried. I'm like, all right, that's actually a good touch. I don't know if that's just coincidence or a mistake, but I mean, he actually looks like he's breaking out in a sweat out of nervousness.
Yeah.
Like, that's an interesting
touch. He looks anxious.
That's pretty much the last you see that character.
Yes. I mean, that it doesn't carry it. Yeah. Then you just hear that she's upset because he's been pinned with it or pinned for it. But then, you know, again, there's just no stakes. There's no risk to any of these characters.
No, we find out he's in jail, accused of this crime.
Mm-hmm. But we don't see him arrested.
We spend time with his wife. His wife, Dale, and the bank secretary, Judy, are staying with Cornelia at the house. And they're all smiling and having tea. And I'm like, shouldn't she be, like, stressed beyond belief because her husband is spending who knows how long in prison now?
I think she's, like, worried, but she's not, like, in tears, like, you guys have to help me. I know he's innocent. It's more, oh, thank you so much for having me over. This is a very tough time for me, which is, I guess I kind of also had the whole feeling, because if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Wells is there, too. And I kept kind of thinking, I feel like he's hitting on her. Is he hitting on her? Like, I kind of feel maybe he's not supposed to be hitting on her.
Yeah,
but
it's so kind of 1950s. There's a moment where they call John Fleming's son Mark Fleming, who's a realtor in town, and he's talking with Dale, who is a married woman, and he keeps calling her sweetheart over the phone. Oh, hey, sweetheart. No, I'll be over. Yeah, I'll come over later and I'll help you find the plans. All right, bye, sweetheart.
I didn't even notice that.
Yes.
But that is interesting. I had a conversation with somebody about a character in a story calling another character boy. And the perception from this other person I was talking to was that then the character was a young boy, but it was actually dialectic, right? It was like people used to talk down. Ugh, this is a horrible example, and I'm sorry. Like people might say it to the waiter. Boy, yes. bring me my check, boy. Like it's a way to talk down to somebody. And I think probably it's similar in this case. Oh, of course, sweetheart, I'll be right there. Not like sweetheart, you know, but like, oh, yes, sweet, you know, which is, again, it's hard to say that casually. But it's probably dialectic. But at the same time, yes, it feels a bit strange. There's quite a bit that's a bit strange in this movie, but not strange in the way you want it to be strange. And it ends up, to me, it feels like a comedy take on an Agatha Christie book. It's like if somebody had taken an Agatha Christie book and adapted it to a comedy, but then taken away all of the mystery and the drama in it by doing that and decided to change the ending so that it's like wah wah instead of like, oh, wow.
Well, and it's particularly bizarre that the title character is completely inconsequential. Honestly, the culprit could still go around the house and looking for this secret stash of money. He spends a lot of time trying not to be seen. He doesn't need to be the bat.
Yeah, he could literally be the guy in the stocking cap. Or the stocking hat. What am I trying to say here? The balaclava. I've got baklava on the head. In the head. Oh, okay. That's it. That's the sign. Yes, you're right. Completely inconsequential. There's no reason for him to be a bat. It's, again, there just is a lot that's carried over from the 1926 that works well in the 1926. The only reason for him to be a bat in 1926 is to fly. And I'm going to have to go back and look that up because I'm so convinced that he was flying and it made me giggle. I loved it. It was charming. But I think the reason he's the bat in this is because he was the bat in the original. And they didn't have to be the bat in this because there's no reason for it. But they brought the storyline over, and so they kept the movie the same, probably for the same reason that they keep movie titles the same these days that have no similarity to the original movie, but they keep the title the same because they're trying to get people to come and see it. And so they're like, oh yeah, kids who were 10 years old when The Bat came out in 1926 are going to see this and go, oh, The Bat, I saw that when I was a kid and I was riveted. I'm going to go see it again now that I'm 45 years old. And we do the same darn thing today. We fall for it every freaking time, Hollywood. God! When they remake Goonies, I'm going to boycott the world, but we'll leave it there. You know it's going to happen. Why? But you know it's going to happen at some point. And this is probably a good example of that happening too, that people were like, oh, The Bat. Yeah, I remember that from when I was a kid. And it probably drew some people in. I'm sure some people came just for The Mummy and got The Bat too.
Yeah. Yeah, and The Mummy was definitely the better film out of this double bill.
Yeah.
I'm curious whether that was the case back then or if it was just sort of a cost saving. Effectively, you've already got the script.
Mm-hmm.
So you just redo it.
Yeah.
You know, was it a cheap film to make just because you've already got it?
Well, they remade hundreds and hundreds of silent films into talkies. And maybe the bigger question is, why did it take them so long to remake it? I would have expected them to recycle it. They recycled everything else. And you know, with good reason. You're not wrong. There's cost savings. There's familiarity. There's, you know, even the things that they remade that intentionally had no similarity to the original source material. You're always trying to harken back to something that somebody remembered before and loved. And there must have been some people that loved it and were excited to see it again. But you never know.
There's another adaptation called The Bat Whispers, I think.
Yeah, you had mentioned.
I was trying to go back and find out what year that came out. Oh, okay, there you go. 1930?
Roland West.
Yeah, so that was the first actual talkie version of the film. I'm curious what that one was like. And so it was a silent made into a talkie and then another talkie made into another talkie.
Another talkie. It's interesting. It looks like in the 30s version, Dale was maybe Cornelia's daughter or niece. Oh, but she's the niece. She's a niece in the 59 version as well, isn't she? I know she's in the 29 version.
No, Dale is just...
Or 26, darn it.
She's the new wife of Victor.
In the 59. In the 26, she is...
Oh.
She's said to be the niece of Cornelia.
Yes, correct. Yes, she's in the house with her niece, yes.
Yes. So it looks like it's probably fairly similar. I'm looking for... There's a Dr. Venries, different than Dr. Wells. There's also a Dr. Bell, but not a Dr. Wells. So it sounds like there's maybe a little bit of difference, but some similarities too. I think you're exactly right. It'd be interesting to see it, to see how much of it they changed. Yeah, again, this is one of those movies where there's some familiarity in the actors. I think we overlook the fact that Vincent Price was in some real stinkers because he's so beloved. And he is, and he's delightful to watch, and he's always Vincent Price. Always, always Vincent Price. Even when he's, you know, got a bit in a Michael Jackson song, he's still Vincent Price.
Right.
You know, so we love him. So it's fun to see the movies, but the movies aren't always as fun as seeing the actors.
Yeah, Vincent Price is one of the few actors where he still looks incredibly debonair when he's wearing an apron and doing the dishes.
Yeah, in flannel. Vincent Price in plaid flannel. I was like, whoa. Hello, Mr. Price. I didn't see that one coming. But, yeah. And on that note, maybe we should rate this movie. It gets a whole extra Othel for that plaid shirt.
Yeah, we should just go ahead and get to the ratings, which I think I probably won't come as too much surprise. I don't think either one of us will probably put this one very high.
Oh, yeah, definitely a 5 for me, too.
This is a film that if you are some sort of completionist, that you want to see all the Vincent Price films, you want to see all the Agnes Moorehead films or something like that, then this is, you know, it's a fine film to watch, to check it off the list.
Yeah, but it is to put on in the background while you're doing the dishes in a flannel shirt.
Yeah, or that. I'm only going to give this like, and it pains me to say it, because of this cast and because of the few little moments that I think are really brilliant, but are just overshadowed by everything that's just bland, I'm only going to give it a 2. I can't really bring myself to go any higher than that.
I think that it's the expectations being what they are. It's like, this is going to be good. It's going to be Vincent Price. It's just, yeah, you're exactly right. You're right on the mark with a 2. I'd like to give it a 3, but I would only like to give it a 3. I can't in good conscience. I think it's too bad. I think it's actually getting a lower rating than maybe it would if it didn't have such a good cast in it. If the source material weren't actually more engaging as a silent film than as a talking film. I really, now that we're talking about the 1931, that would be, I think, really interesting to visit at some point, even if we do it unofficially, and maybe just follow up with a tag on this episode and just say, hey guys, we watched the 1931 also, and here's our thought on that. But yeah, this is, unfortunately, the late 1950s had a host of kind of stinker films. Every era had a host of stinker films. This is around the same time frame as The Red House. And this is 2 years after The Red House, which I think we both gave 5 Othels.
Yeah. I think we were really impressed with that one.
Yeah, and there's, which is also an adaptation, and there is the potential for some really good storytelling. And for whatever reason, they chose to play this off as a dime novel, kind of silly, goofy mystery, and which is fine. These movies exist. These type of movies exist. There are better versions of something similar out there. I think Adam West did one on TV. I'm joking. Just kidding. But there are other movies out there about bats that are scarier from this era. And maybe go watch one of those. And watch the 1926 version of this. It's another silent film. We just did Beau Geste. I don't think expected to love that as much as we did. But I think the 1926 version of this is more worth the watch than the 1959 version.
Yeah, I almost want to give an Othel rating to the 1926 film, but I'm afraid that it might spoil it if we decide to go back and cover it at a future date.
I'm not too worried about us doing that because the story just being so similar. I could see us doing the 1930 in the future, maybe in 5 years when it's been in public domain.
Right. You
know? But I think there's no surprise that we would give the 1926 a much higher rating.
Yeah.
For its time period and what it did, and for the storyline as it's played out and directed, I think it's just much better.
I was just looking at one of the posters for this film of The Bat. And it's another one of these things where it's the 1950s and the poster is far more exciting than the film.
A lady just splayed across, you know, with her dress all ripped and a bat flying overhead.
When
I see
it flies,
the same one.
Someone dies.
Yeah, which is, yes, which makes me think again of the 1926 because I really think he flies in it. I have to go back and check it. I encourage you all to go and check it too.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and double check and watch that. I don't remember seeing him flying. He was just this strange man in a bat costume, which supposedly, reportedly, the 1926 film was actually played a part in the inspiration for Bob Kane to create Batman.
I believe it. I really believe it because I think
I do, too. After seeing the film, I absolutely believe it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. It's something where I would want to do something with a character like that.
I honestly, if anyone's listening and you're a Batman fan, go and watch this film. I guarantee you there is going to be at least one moment in there that you're going to go, holy crap.
I want to exit on the Batman theme now. It's copyrighted, but if I sing it, I can do it, right?
It's a cover, yeah.
Yeah, less than 8 seconds. Here we go. Count. No. But yeah, fun for, if this is the inspiration for Batman, then I'm super happy that it was made. I'm super happy it was made, even if it wasn't the original one, even if it wasn't the inspiration for Batman.
But yes, yeah, so go see the 26 film and skip the 59. Yeah, pretty much
unless you're just desperate for another Vincent Price film and you've seen all the others.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it.
I will be working through Agnes Moorehead's backlog probably over the next month. So I'm super excited about that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's so many movies in here aside from The Opposite Sex that I'm going, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be good. Keep your powder dry. That's all I got to say. Go look it up.
All right. Well, I think that is going to do it for The Bat. So, yeah, not a fantastic watch, but still fun to talk about with you, Lydia. I always have a good time.
Yeah, me as well. I'm glad we visited it, and especially because it led us to the 26 version.
Very much. I'm glad I just, out of just curiosity, I was like, I've got to go and check this one out, and I'm so glad I did there.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. We will be back in a month with another film. Until then, everyone stay safe and have a great... Oh, this was the October episode, wasn't it?
Yeah. This is the October episode. Happy Halloween.
We hope everyone has a fantastic Halloween and has been enjoying their spooky season. We're sorry this film didn't fit more into the into the theme. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Go like the little spinny